A cave, Latimer? Is that really the best you could do?
There's nothing wrong with a cave, ma'am. I've had some fine times in caves before.
Name one.
I'm sorry, ma'am?
Name one nice time you've had in a cave that didn't end disastrously.
Well, there's this one, ma'am.
This doesn't count. It isn't over yet.
I did meet Darth Latimer in a cave once.
Now you're just being silly. Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't eaten all of the chocolate chili yourself, despite having made enough for a family of 10. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Well, this cave may not be the most glamorous location for a tea lair, but I can see that Latimer has done his best to make it as cozy as possible. It's actually quite warm in here, and he's even put down a rug for us. Not that I can see what colour it is rather dark in here. Probably best for you all to huddle round the candles on the tea table and keep away from those shadows at the edges. And do mind your head, there are a few stalactites dotted around. At least, I hope that's what they are.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Peter V. Brett.
Splendid, let's see his calling card. Peter V. Brett, Union Square, NYC.
Ah, yes, the No Yellow Custard Association. Very specific, but on that one topic, my goodness, they can be vicious.
No, Latimer, NYC stands for New York City.
If you insist, ma'am, but I think we both know who's right.
Well, I definitely do. Oh, that's an interesting picture. It's an open hand with a tattoo on the palm. What do you think of it, Latimer?
Ugh, horrible. Keep it away from me, ma'am.
Oh, well, show him in, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Peter V. Brett is the best-selling author of the Demon Cycle series. The fourth book in the series, The Skull Throne, was published earlier this year. He has also had several novellas set in the Demon Cycle world, published by Subterranean Press.
Mr. Peter V. Brett, ma'am.
Hello, Peter. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Thank you. Very well. You know, I've never seen wall-to-wall carpeting in a cave before.
Well, the butler does make a real effort to make it nice and cozy for us. It was a bit of a rough floor, so I understand he did that. I'm assuming he did. He's gone again. Well, never mind. Do take a seat.
Thank you.
Would you care for some tea?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
How do you take your tea?
Black with a dollop of honey, please.
Ooh, honey. I think you may be a first.
And don't be spare with it. I went to the gym today.
Marvellous. I'll pour. And I was wondering if you would like a fondant fancy.
I don't know what that is, but yes, I would love one.
It's the most gorgeous little cake. Usually, you know, in good company, you would have at least two or three. I think four is actually quite perfect. They're teeny tiny cubes of sponge cake, and they sometimes have a tiny layer of jam, and then they have a layer of marzipan and a dollop of buttercream, and then they're covered in icing. So it's the most amazing sugar rush in the Western Hemisphere, actually.
This is why I gained 6 pounds on my British tour earlier this year.
We're very good at cake.
Yes, indeed you are. And oh, these are lovely. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Don't mind the chickens over there. They won't bother you. You're not allergic to feathers, are you?
No. Cat hair, but not feathers. I think we're safe.
Oh, good.
Why are there chickens over there, may I ask?
Oh, well, those are my pet chickens. They're very special chickens. But we'll get to that later. Let's have a little bit of tea and cake first. One shouldn't rush an introduction to the special chickens.
I went to author Mark Lawrence's house, and he too has chickens. This is another British thing I'm having to get used to.
Yes, these aren't the average British chickens, but I get ahead of myself. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
Well, I brought this lovely warded knife that a fan gave to me at my launch event at Forbidden Planet in London earlier this year.
Oh, wow.
She had done a full cosplay of one of my characters, and the character has this knife that, as you can see, has these magical symbols along the blade. And she very generously gave it to me, but I was traveling carry-on only and was expecting that the airlines would confiscate it. And so, so I left it in the UK with instructions that it'd be sent on to me later, and it vanished briefly and has suddenly appeared in my mailbox after 2 months, and I'm so happy to have it back that I've been squeezing it and loving it and thought I would take it to show off. And I've heard there's some kind of peril here, so a knife might be appropriate.
Some sort of peril?
I've been warned.
Really? I must talk to Latimer about this. I was worried that we would get a reputation. But no, you'll be quite safe. Everything will be fine. None of my guests have succumbed to anything permanently awful.
Wandering into a cave is usually indicative of something about to go wrong.
Well, that's why we have tea and cake.
Yeah, there's very few caves with tea and cake in them now.
Now, it's interesting that you talk about this knife, because I wanted to ask you about your fans cosplaying and even tattoos. I was wondering which has been the cosplay or tattoo that has most impressed you.
I am very fortunate to be able to say that there have been so many that it's difficult to call out one or another. I guess, you know, the first time that somebody dresses up as one of your characters and shows up at an event is transcendently wonderful. I admit that I have stacked the deck somewhat. As I'm sure is the case with you, my book contract requires the publishers to send me additional copies of all of my books to give away to people. And because I live in a small apartment in New York City, I tend to have contests to just give away as many books as possible so I don't accrue too many books that I don't have room to hold on to. And I've been doing fan art contests, and I usually try and keep them something so that people can be creative. And I've done cosplay contests and warding contests and naughty limerick contests and all of these different sorts of things. And so that sort of maybe helped create a lot of the fan art. It's always impressive when someone gets a tattoo. I'm always worried that I'm going to kill off their favorite character and then they're going to hate me forever because they're permanently marked.
Oh my goodness, yes. I don't know. I would be quite freaked out in some way if somebody had something tattooed. Do you feel the kind of responsibility, apart from the one that you've just said about the character?
Well, the thing is that people get tattoos of the ward symbols, which are the magical symbols in the books. And the artist who designed them, Lauren Cannon, made these beautiful, beautiful symbols that are lovely to look upon whether you know what their meaning is or not. And
yes,
so it's not like someone is tattooing my name or the name of one of my characters or like a picture of something, you know, like they're these sort of abstract symbols and they're very beautiful. And so, I don't worry over much that people are going to regret having them because they're so beautiful. I just worry that, you know, at some point, if I disappoint them as an author, they will regret the decision.
I love seeing tattoos on other people, but I could never have one myself.
Mm.
Apart from the needle phobia, which really, you know, is a bit of a barrier. It's also the thought that I have changed so much over the years that I would be stuck with something that wouldn't be meaningful to me anymore. So I should think it's really quite a compliment to have somebody love your work so much that they are confident they would want to be with that symbol forever.
It absolutely is. It is a transcendent compliment. And I've always felt some people just like to get tattoos and that is fine. But I've always felt that tattoos should be something personal that's important to you that you would be happy to have with you for your entire life. I have one tattoo that was sort of very carefully chosen to be something that meant a lot to me. When you're at a certain point in your life and you read a book that resonates with you and sometimes it'll help you through a difficult time or sometimes it just makes you so gloriously happy or sometimes it imparts a bit of wisdom that you apply to the rest of your life. We all have those books that have that special place in our heart because we read them at the right time in our life, you know, at the right moment when we were in the right state of mind. And maybe it wouldn't have affected us if we'd read them at some other time, but because of how we did, they stay with us. And so I have books that I feel that way about too. And even if the author has gone on to write other books that I didn't like, I've never turned on the ones that were special and formative to me when I was younger. And so I can understand it theoretically, but it's still a kind of, for me, difficult when someone's doing it with my work. It's very difficult for me. It's very easy for me to look up to other authors and think of them as these, you know, creators of these transcendent works of art. But I see the nails and spackle behind the paint of my own work. And so it's harder for me to look at my own books in the same way.
I understand that from bitter personal experience. I've read your blog for some time, and I know that you are the father of a young daughter, and I loved the post you wrote about Axis of Villains.
Mm.
I was wondering if being the father of a young daughter has changed the way that you enjoy books and films and television as well.
It has. I always considered myself a feminist, you know, for as long as I've been socially aware, I guess since I got to college and started thinking about the wider world around me. Like, I've always considered myself to be a feminist. I've always included a lot of female characters in my books and had them in various different walks of life and at various ages and various different positions of power. And so that's something that I've always sort of done in my work to begin with. But having a young daughter and trying to get her to like the same things that I like has really sort of skewed my perspective on media now. It's interesting because you want your child to like enough of the same stuff that you like so that you can tolerate being around them when they're watching TV or watching a movie or something like that. And so I've always sort of stacked the deck and encouraged my daughter to watch animated fantasy movies. You know, I'd much rather she be watching How to Train Your Dragon than you know, Barney or something. Mm-hmm. And so I try and get her to like the same things that I like so that I can sit and watch a movie with her or sit and watch TV with her or whatever and enjoy it too. But what I've noticed is how few female characters there are in so many of the formative movies and TV shows that I love.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, she's incredibly into Star Wars, and Star Wars has one female character. Like any given Star Wars movie has one female character. You know, maybe there's a couple of other women sort of in the background that don't really have speaking parts, but in general, there's one female character, and sometimes that female character is kidnapped and dressed as a sex slave. And so these things make it very difficult when she doesn't notice as much as I do, but we'll be sitting next to each other and she'll be watching the movie and I'll be sort of squirming saying, like, what example is this setting and why aren't there that? And it's difficult for me because I have to, you know, it doesn't change the fact that I love these things, that these were works of art that were formative to me and shaped who I am today. And I can't stop loving them. But at the same time, I see them in a whole new light now. And it's made it made a much more difficult sort of search for me to find things that teach her what I want to teach her, but are also like in the vein of science fiction and fantasy and comic books and things that I love so that we can sort of enjoy the things that I love together.
I think that issue of what it's teaching our children as well is really tricky because I have a son. Mm. And so for him, of course, being a boy, he has 11 billion male role models to pick and choose from at his leisure. But the treatment of women and female characters and girls in a lot of the very geeky stuff we watch is really problematic to me. And so it's always trying to strike that balance of really enjoying, as you say, the things that I have loved, but also trying to make him gently aware of some of these other issues, but not in a kind of bashing my son over the head with my feminism stick. And it's really tricky sometimes. But, you know, thank God for Avatar, The Last of Airbender, and Korra, and things like that.
Yeah, we just started watching those, and I agree, they are amazing and sort of a wonderful example of doing it right. It's always a challenge, but it's something that, you know, this is what it's like to be a parent. You have to worry about these things, and you have to gently stack the deck while they're not looking so that it seems natural to them, but they're getting fed the sort of information that you want them to get and the worldview and ethics that you want to teach them. it doesn't always work out because everyone is different and everyone processes things differently, and things that bother you are not going to bother your child, and things that bother your child are not going to bother you. And
we're never going to know which ones they are either. It's always going to be the blind spot that's going to get us.
Yeah, it'll be many years before we realize how we failed as parents. It will happen, and it's inevitable, but...
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why we have to laugh about it, because otherwise it's drink ourselves into oblivion. But we can only try our best. It's like writing books, isn't it? Long after it's gone out of your hands, you'll realize that you made some terrible error that you wish you could take back. Wow, that's quite bleak. I've had a hard day.
Thankfully, I haven't ever felt that I made a horrible error that I wish I could take back with either my child or my books yet. but we'll see.
We met briefly at the Sci-Fi Weekender some years ago before we nearly froze to death. Mm. My God, it was cold that weekend.
I was all prepared for how cold that convention was.
I don't think any of us were prepared for how cold that was going to be.
Well,
oh, my life.
I've been traveling for 10 days straight with one tiny suitcase and had not been informed that we would be in a trailer park in the middle of Snowdonia.
Yeah, that was special. But anyway, I remember on the panel that we were on together, you were talking about 9/11, and you said something that really stuck with me all of these years later, that you saw more people running towards the towers than away in the hours after it happened. And I was wondering if all these years later after 9/11, whether your faith in humanity has remained good or if it's being eroded.
That's a very good question. It's interesting because these big events are the things that always sort of, even as they are horrible and terrible, they also reinforce your faith in humanity. There have been so many events. The Hurricane Sandy here in New York City was another firsthand experience for me, but earthquakes all over the world, or anytime there's a massive event where people are in danger or people are harmed or people need help, their neighbors come to their aid. It's inevitable. It happens in every society, and the world always sort of comes together. And I think that it's a reminder that our first impulses are usually to help each other and be good. The problem is that after the immediate danger has passed and we're faced with more complex decisions than do I help that person or not right now, that's when we start to show our human weaknesses and begin to fail each other. And so I think that when the choices are very stark and very immediate, the best of us comes out. And when the choices get more complex and sort of involve deep thinking and problems that don't have easy solutions, that's when we start to fail. And so my faith in humanity is sort of like a roller coaster. It goes up and down depending on things, depending on what new ripple has hit the internet.
Yeah. I try not to base my evaluation of humanity on the internet as much as I can. Otherwise, it may just be too harsh.
This is wise.
I think it also has something to do with immediate suffering as well. That's actually very difficult to witness. And I don't know if it's the same for everyone. I was in hospital for some time last year, and there were other women in the same ward as me who were much, much, much more ill than I was and unable to care for themselves as much as I could. And I couldn't bear the fact that they were suffering. So it was a very first-hand experience of wanting to alleviate immediate suffering in a way that I'd never, thankfully, had experienced before.
That's a very good way of putting it. And I think that it's like that. I mean, certainly in any major city, New York in particular, if you see somebody fall down on the sidewalk or trip down the steps coming in and out of the subway or something like that, people will immediately rush to help them, rush to help them up, rush to help get them to a doctor, rush to do whatever they can to help them out. But the homeless person that's sitting in the same spot every day becomes invisible. And so it is that sort of immediate suffering that we want to alleviate. But the more subtle things, it becomes easier to look away. And I don't know that necessarily is you know, proof that people in their nature are evil. I don't believe that. It's just our instincts can take over when there's an immediate problem in a way that they don't otherwise. That's my bit of philosophy for the day.
The next question may sound a little bit serious, but when you get to the end, you'll see that it isn't. So I want you to imagine that everyone in the world has been wiped out by an apocalypse.
Oh, that's easy.
But you have survived, and you have the means to repopulate the planet with clones. However, you only have the genetic material of three other people. Which three people would you most like to have so that you can repopulate the planet with their clones?
Wow. That is a difficult and complex question. So there's three people in addition to myself.
Yes.
Yeah, sadly, you know, it's probably a speaks ill of me. I'm immediately thinking of how many beautiful movie stars I could clone and fill the world with.
But then I mean, that's refreshingly honest.
No, it's that's the thing. Like, I'm sitting like, well, you know, the world could be filled with Scarlett Johansson and that would not be a problem. But then, you know, I guess I should probably clone, like, somebody smart. You know, you'd probably need intelligent people more than beautiful people if we want to repopulate the Earth properly.
Depends on which long-term things you're considering.
Well, yeah, it's like for my lifetime, it's like I would choose, you know, three beautiful movie stars and have done. And then we could repopulate the old-fashioned way. But
do you need another fondant fancy as you consider this?
I'm literally, like, thinking, like, would I want Elon Musk? No. Probably Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's funny, but he's probably not as hard science as we would need. We'd need somebody who could, like, get all the machines working again. And, like, I'm going to overthink this problem and probably come up with a wonderful solution 3 days from now and email you about it.
You know, if I was put on the spot, I don't think I would be able to come up with three people immediately, other than, well, Tom Hiddleston would be one of them.
Sure. Okay.
But that's my kind of Scarlett Johansson equivalent.
So, okay, so one beautiful movie star. We've got Scarlett Johansson. We'll just go with that. I won't overthink that. We'll need one scientist. Let's say, for argument's sake, Elon Musk, although there are certainly probably better options if I really gave it a lot of thought, but we'd definitely need cars. And then the last person, I guess...
Someone strong. You'd have to have someone strong and kind of survivally.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Maybe Mike Cole. Maybe my friend Mike Cole.
Yes!
Yes. Because when the zombies come, he's been always my go-to person for when the zombies come. But then let's take out Scarlett Johansson and replace her with my girlfriend. keep me out of trouble. And then... I don't know anyone personally who could, like, fix all the machines, so I'm gonna ponder that one. But Mike Cole, when the zombies come after the apocalypse to sort of sweep the slate clean, Mike Cole is gonna be the person you want by your side.
Yeah, definitely. He is the, like, on my list of, like, top three people, it's my dad who, not just because he's my dad, but he used to be a survival officer in the Royal Navy. He knows everything about surviving in every environment on Earth. So he is number one, and then it would be Mike Cole.
He is on every author zombie survival team. It's kind of interesting.
And he's such a lovely chap with it. When I have a guest over for tea, I like to ask my lovely friends on the Twitters if they have a question for the lovely person who's coming to take tea. And somebody called Kai said they would like to know how you celebrate finalizing a book. Do you celebrate?
Well, the thing is that when is the book done? This is the question that I always have for myself. Is it done when you finish your first draft?
No.
Is it done when you turn it into the publisher? Is it done when you do the rewrite? Is it done when you do the copy edit?
No.
Is it done when you're done with the, when you're complete, when you sign off on the proofread and all the creative work is done and then you're just doing promotion? Like, at what point do you get to call it done?
Yeah, I would say when your box of author copies arrives.
Oh, that's when it's done. Okay.
Yes, I will make an arbitrary decision. It's my tea, Lair, so I will say it's when the box of books arrives.
My usual celebration point is when the first draft is done, because for me that is the biggest hurdle. I think getting to the ending once and then getting to put it aside for a little while, I think is the moment that I most feel like celebrating. Rewrites are difficult and tedious and never a pleasant time, but I never worry about them the way I do about that finishing that first draft. And so that's usually when I celebrate. My girlfriend and I will usually do something private. We're not big champagne drinkers, but we'll go out to dinner or otherwise celebrate. One time we threw a party, but that was because the finishing the book also coincided with my 40th birthday. So we made signature cocktails based on the series, and we had a belly dancer who was dressed as a character from the books. And
that sounds amazing.
It was an amazing. It was my girlfriend Lauren threw the party. It was best party I've ever been to. It was amazing.
Anything with cocktails and belly dances is immediately a success.
Agreed.
So that's one something that I find interesting, because obviously all of us authors are very strange and diverse people, and we all celebrate and bemoan a lot of very similar things, but also a lot of very different things. Do you celebrate when you hold the final book in your hand, or is that just a kind of quiet satisfaction?
Well, I always, whenever I open a box of books that somebody sent me, I take pictures of them and I tweet them pretty much immediately to show how excited I am. What I don't show other people is that the first thing I do every time I get a new edition of a book is I hug it.
Yes, me too. Yes.
I don't usually selfie and post it, but that is my first impulse, and I've never failed to do it with a new book. It's like my children, you know, like they're so special to me and precious to me, and I just, my impulse is to hug, and so I do.
Yes, I'm a hugger too, of books and people, so I totally understand that. It's a lovely moment, that, actually, the first hug with your book.
Yeah.
Now, this year is a bit of a special year for you, because you have two books out.
Yeah.
Which is quite remarkable. So one of them came out in January, is that right?
Yeah, I in between each one of my large novels, because I'm a fantasy author and it takes me years to write the large novels, I always write a novella that ties into the main series, sometimes only tangentially and sometimes, in the case of this year, directly. So I have a shorter book that comes out sort of as an appetizer while I'm busy doing promotion and setup and getting ready for the novel to come out. So this January, a book called Messenger's Legacy came out, which is meant to tie directly into the fourth book in the Demon Cycle series, The Skull Throne, which came out in April. Mm-hmm. So I've had two books to promote this year, and then, you know, none the year before and probably none next year. But this is the life of a big, fat, epic fantasy author, I guess.
It's like buses. You wait for one for ages, and then two come at once.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Skull Throne was on the Times hardback fiction bestsellers list, wasn't it?
Yeah, we actually made it 2 weeks in a row. The book came out on Thursday, and I guess just the pre-orders put it on the list. And then it stayed on. It debuted at number 5 and then dropped to number 7 the following week. But just staying on for 2 weeks is such a huge honor to me. I was thrilled. I admit that I squeed. And I also hugged the copy of the list that my publisher sent to me. I hug a lot of things.
Is that framed and on your wall now?
It will be soon. I have it waiting to be framed.
Yes, I don't blame you at all. That is an incredible achievement. You mentioned the chickens earlier, and I said that one should wait until we have the required amount of tea and cake in our system before I explain the chickens to you. These chickens are quite special because they sing, and they seem to know every single tune that I've ever asked them to sing. I don't know how or why, but they do. And so what I've taken to doing is inviting my tea guests to tell me the theme tune that you would choose for your life, so that we can see if the chickens know that too. So I was wondering what you would consider to be the theme tune of your life.
The theme tune of my entire life. Wow. I would like it to, I mean, you know, I would want to say that it's something really awesome, you know, like The Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin or something like that. But if I was being more honest, it would probably end up being Shake It Off.
By Taylor Swift.
I've come to like Taylor Swift. I hate to admit it, but there it is.
I haven't actually consumed much Taylor Swift at all, but I have seen that she's remarkably popular on the internet. Oh my God, I sound so old saying that.
Well, you pluralize internet, so that's already kind of dating yourself.
I can't get out of the habit. I usually call it Tay Interwebs, which is even worse. But anyway.
I used to spend all of my time, my writing time, listening to sort of instrumental music so that I wouldn't be distracted by the lyrics. And so I'd pick these sort of very uplifting soundtracks to listen to. And then about a year ago, I just switched and started listening to like the pop stations on like internet radio. And I haven't really looked back. And so I find myself suddenly like feeling like dancing to all sorts of bizarre things lately.
Like Shake It Off.
Like Shake It Off. But I'd be impressed if the chickens can sing that.
I would too, because I don't know it. So, okay, little chickens, please could you sing Shake It Off by Taylor Swift? Oh, well, there you go. They know that too. That is remarkable.
Wow, yeah, it sounds even better than the original.
I'll have to go and find the original now just to see if I agree. I've been hearing lots of wonderful things about Taylor Swift, so I do feel that I should go and seek out her music.
I guess even now, chickens feel like they're being unfairly criticized sometimes and just need to shake their feathers off and get on with their lives.
Yeah, I think so. And my butler isn't very fond of the chickens, so I think that...
Well, he has to clean them.
Yes, and clean up after them, I suppose.
This lovely plush carpet probably gets quite mangled.
Yes, probably best not to think too much about that. Now, let me see. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. And actually, I think I might have just polished off the last fondant fancy. Sorry, I'm a bit of a fiend for them.
They are delicious.
Yes, yes. You'll be flying off that for at least half an hour and then you'll feel awful. I do apologise. That leaves for me to say thank you so much for coming and taking tea with me today in my little tea lair. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It's the most comfortable cave I've ever been in.
Isn't it? Yes, and not at all damp.
More like a hobbit hole.
Yes, it's quite dark, so maybe there are things... Oh, I don't want to think too hard about what might be lurking in the corners. Mm-hmm. But I can see the light from the entrance over there, so the butler will show you the right way out, and I will hopefully see you at a convention sometime soon.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was lovely. What a splendid chap. Oh, where have all the lights come from? It's like we're in a disco. In a cave.
Ah, I knew this cave was familiar.
If you tell me this is a monster's lair, Latimer, there's going to be serious trouble.
No, ma'am, it's the karaoke cave. You know the one. In the karaoke cave, you sing or you die. Just as the sign says over there.
But what if I don't want to sing?
Not to worry, ma'am. The spotlight seems to have chosen Mr. Peter V. Brett as its first victim. And of course, by victim, I mean star.
Oh, yes. He's actually on a stage. I didn't notice the microphone on the way in. And who are all those shadowy figures? I've never seen so many sequins.
Those are the disco demons, ma'am. They do love a bit of karaoke. And human flesh.
Oh, my!
You are in the karaoke cave. And in the karaoke cave, you sing or you die.
Well, in my Demon Cycle novels, we have a character named Roger Halfgrip. He's a jongleur. He's also on the UK cover of The Skull Throne, if you want to know what he looks like. His ability is to charm demons with his violin. He can make them forget that he's there so that he can pass by unharmed. He can drive them away with the promise of prey elsewhere. But most powerfully, with an endless series of jarring notes and discordant sounds that can inflict very real harm on the monsters. But I have something even greater. A recording of my 6-year-old daughter's last violin recital, which I can play at the click of a button. I will hostage the whole world before I'm bullied into singing.
No, anything but that. Go, go, you are free.
They've let him go. Oh, why is it so bright?
It's the spotlight, ma'am. They've turned it on us.
You are in the karaoke cave, and in the karaoke cave you sing or you die.
What are we going to do?
As much as I hate to say it, Mom, there's only one thing we can do. I woke up this morning. My chicken was dead. Came back as a zombie. So I shot off its head.
Latimer, I'll do the next verse. I woke up this morning. It was only a dream. The chickens are chipper. There's no need to scream. Now the chickens.
Encourage me to go! Go! Please!
Oh, well, that wasn't as bad as I feared. Once you've survived the Fantasy Con karaoke, you can survive anything.
Fantasy Con karaoke? I once sang karaoke in front of an audience of ghouls in the Halls of the Dead, and the only record they had within my hearing range was Chris de Burr's Lady in Red. That is something that one survives.
Oh, how awful. Well, whilst Latimer is packing the tea things away, I would like to raise my teacup to Katrin, the latest member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order and discover how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy. All done, Latimer? Splendid. Find us a new tea there, would you? Preferably somewhere without a stage and the pressure to perform.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes, and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.